My name is Laura Thomas, and I work at the Drug Policy Alliance, where I'm the Deputy State Director in California. But I'm delighted to be included in this session because in my spare time, I sit on the Ryan White Planning Council in San Francisco and have been involved with it one way or another since the very beginning. So it's always nice to make those connections. But I'm going to be talking a little bit about a different topic, the intersection between HIV and drug policy reform. My disclosures. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the intersection between HIV and drug use in terms of the epidemic, some of the lessons that we could be learning from other countries, a particular focus on supervised injection services as an HIV intervention, and then some policy recommendations for the U.S. So, as I said, I work for the Drug Policy Alliance. We're a nonprofit advocacy group focused on promoting a public health response to drugs, drug use, and people who use drugs instead of a criminal justice response. And I'm delighted to say that I was late for this session starting because the APHA Governing Council just approved a policy statement that we put before them about defining and implementing a public health response to drug use. So I'm very excited about that. I am happy that I can count on the public health community to look at science and evidence. So HIV and drug use, I probably don't have to say very much about this in this room. Sharing injection equipment continues to be a major driver of the HIV epidemic in the U.S. Other drug use, particularly alcohol, drives risky behaviors that can transmit HIV. And the criminalization and incarceration of people who use drugs creates even more problems. At this point, about a third of all AIDS cases in the U.S. are directly connected to syringe sharing, and then more are indirectly connected by, for example, women in heterosexual relationships with men who've been injecting drugs. Everyone, including the CDC and the American Public Health Association, agrees that syringe access programs are very effective at lowering HIV incidence, and yet Congress has continued to refuse to fund, to allow federal funds to be used for this very effective intervention. And so the UN reference group came up with an estimate that we are in the U.S. distributing about 21 syringes per year per injection drug user. So that's clearly not enough to provide a sterile syringe for every injection. And this is really about accidental drug overdose, but at least in San Francisco, drug overdoses are increasingly a leading cause of death for people living with HIV and AIDS. Accidental drug overdose is now the second leading non-AIDS-related cause of death after non-AIDS-related cancers for people living with AIDS. And then criminalization creates very additional risks and barriers to treatment. We know from a number of different studies that aggressive drug law enforcement is associated with higher HIV rates, that people who use drugs tend to have lower rates of utilization of effective HIV medications, and higher rates of death. Incarceration is also associated with higher risk, and we know that probably around a quarter of people living with HIV go through our correctional justice system every year, which is a really appallingly large number. We also know that blacks are far more likely to be incarcerated for drug law violations, even though we know that African Americans actually use drugs at slightly lower rates than whites. They are far more likely to be arrested, convicted, incarcerated, and to serve longer sentences. So this is just a demonstration of the ways in which we have increasingly relied on our criminal justice system to deal with drug law violations. This is the number of adults incarcerated. That top dark blue is federal prisons, the middle is state prisons, and the bottom one is jails, local jails. So then what has this done for us? When you look at the ways that other countries have addressed HIV among people who use drugs, and specifically among people who inject drugs, you can see that they've had some very different rates in terms of HIV prevalence. So Australia, Switzerland, Germany, and the United Kingdom all have dramatically lower HIV prevalence rates among people who inject drugs than the U.S. does, where it's over 15%. And these are numbers generally from 2008. So that brings us to the theme for our conference this year about thinking global and acting local and best practices from around the world, because we have a lot to learn from some other countries. Australia has significantly scaled up their syringe access, and in addition to preventing HIV infections, they've also estimated that they're saving billions of dollars on this. And as you can tell from the same study, where the U.S. was only providing 21, they're providing well over 200 syringes per injection drug user through their system of syringe access. Again, Brazil is another country that scaled up their syringe access, and their HIV cases, the proportion of their HIV cases that were connected to injection drug use dropped from 28% of all of their cases to just 10%, and has continued to go down. Canada is a particular example, given the similarities between Canada and the U.S. They have managed to specifically to integrate supervised injection services into HIV care. The Dr. Peter Center is started as an AIDS hospice in Vancouver. The nurses realized that some of the people in their hospice were leaving against medical advice to go and find their illicit drugs and inject them and then come back. And the nurses decided they needed to figure out a different way to address this, changed their scope of practice in British Columbia to provide supervised injection services. So now if you're a resident of the Dr. Peter Center, you can page one of the nurses. They will come to your room with a cart with the injection equipment, supervise you doing your own injection of your illicit drugs, observe you for any potential overdose or other adverse effects, and that this is considered part of how they provide medical care there. Canada has also moved ahead with researching heroin-assisted treatment as an opiate substitution treatment for people for whom methadone or buprenorphine has not worked, providing pharmaceutical diacetylmorphine in a clinical context. And this has been very effective at engaging people in care, at addressing health and other social and economic outcomes for those individuals. In Canada, this is all comes in the context, particularly in Vancouver. Dr. Julio Montaner and the other folks there are doing a really aggressive test and treat program where they have intentionally integrated harm reduction services and low threshold services into it, and that's been part of how they've been successful at really bringing down the community viral load in Vancouver by making sure that the folks who are very often not engaged in care are welcomed into and engaged in care by providing these kinds of services. Switzerland, again, is another example where they have incorporated supervised injection facilities and heroin-assisted therapy and have seen overall new HIV cases fall really dramatically, as well as certainly HIV cases associated with injection drug use. Portugal is one of the most interesting ones because they took a countrywide legal approach to this. They decriminalized drug possession so that it is not illegal to have in your possession the illicit substances that you would need for 10 days of use. That's how they define it. At the same time, they dramatically scaled up their treatment program, specifically methadone, and they saw their HIV rates go down. So, just a little bit more about the Portugal model. They approached it as a social inclusion model, saying we know that people who use drugs are very frequently excluded from society. How can we address this? Identified their laws criminalizing people who use drugs as part of the barrier to people who use drugs being more involved in in social capital, social culture. So they decriminalized possession, they scaled up their treatment capacity, and they created these dissuasion commissions that consist of health, social workers, legal people who can assess civil penalties, but if needed, but primarily they work with an individual. Do you need to be in treatment, yes or no? Are you driving drunk? Well, why don't we take away your driver's license for a while? They can engage in some punitive penalties, but by and large, it's about getting people into treatment if they need to be in treatment and bypassing the criminal justice system. And they've had really good results, surprisingly. A little bit more about supervised injection facilities specifically. So these are places, or drug consumption rooms, places where people can legally use drugs that they obtain, usually with medical supervision, clinical staff, and extensive referrals and linkages to other services as needed. Insight is the largest one in Vancouver, British Columbia. The British Columbia Center of Excellence in HIV has done an enormous set of evaluations. They found that they reduced public disorder in the area, reduced improperly discarded syringes, that people who used the facility were more likely to enter detox programs and were more likely to stop using drugs. They actually have a detox upstairs from the supervised injection facility, and people can enter it at any time. The overdose, fatal overdose rate, overdose death rate decreased by 35% in the neighborhood. They've been able to attract and retain the set of folks that you want coming in for care, particularly folks who are homeless. And so they've been able to reduce risk behaviors, increase safe practices. It's not caused anyone to start using injection drug use, which is worth saying. It may seem obvious, but it's worth saying. And it's not led to any increases in drug-related crime. Again, these are just some of the quotes from the research. People were 70% less likely to share syringes. The savings in averted HIV-related medical costs are more than sufficient to offset the operating costs. So that all sounds well and good, so why don't we have any here in the U.S.? So on the one hand, there are definitely legal issues, both legal issues related to being in the presence of people who are using illicit substances and medical licensures. There's a set of laws called the Crackhouse Statutes, making it a crime to knowingly allow people to use illicit substances on your premises. And there certainly are political concerns as well, but overall it's because in this country we continue to stereotype, stigmatize, and criminalize people who use drugs instead of treating it fully as a public health approach. So how do we get ahead of the curve? When I talk about a slow learning curve, you know, the analogy I often make is with syringe exchange programs, with needle exchange programs that were heavily controversial when they first started, and now, by and large, everyone agrees that they are effective and should be funded. And so the cost of our learning curve on that was all the individuals who became infected with HIV while we were still, as a country, debating whether or not syringe access worked and should be provided. So we're in a similar place now with some of these interventions, and how are we going to get ahead of the curve? You know, we need to be fully providing full federal funding for all of these prevention interventions, including syringe access, and really scaling it up. We need to pilot and evaluate supervised injection facilities in this country, including integrating them into HIV programs. We really need to continue, and I'm hoping that the ACA will do some of this, but we are particularly missing access to methadone and buprenorphine in correctional settings, despite the large number of people who enter correctional settings dependent on opiates. By and large, most correctional systems do not provide methadone or buprenorphine access. We need to look into some of these additional treatments And finally, we need to decriminalize drug use so people are not facing criminal sanctions for their drug use. And these are a couple of the resources, and I'm done. Thank you.
Questions about this particular presentation, and then we'll open it up for everyone else.
I just had a comment. You know folks who are interested in opioid, and you do marketing program in a local jail, prison, etc. They should contact the New York City Department of Health that's running the Rikers Island jail.
Yes, there are a handful of them. Rikers does. Yes, absolutely. San Francisco County Jail also has a methadone program. You know, it is entirely possible and feasible to do it and to do it well. You know, it's sort of directly observed therapy with essentially, you know, literally captive audience should be a really easy thing for us to be implementing. So
we did get permission, just so you know, to do walking.
That's great. That's fantastic. Good to hear. Any comments, questions?
Yeah, okay. Yes. With respect to the treatment manager, in the state of Massachusetts, you know, I represent Massachusetts. I work for a drug treatment facility that received court order fines under the Massachusetts General Law, Chapter 123, Section 35. That is, it becomes a civil offense. So the you get mandated for treatment. That one was treatment modality when you talk about syringe exchange and heroin assisted therapy, what about coercive therapy? Getting them into treatment and make it a civil offense rather than a criminal offense for treatment measures.
So I mean, I think both the research that we have on how to effectively address problematic substance use, by and large, shows that coercive treatment is not as effective as treatment that is chosen by the individual. And I think when it comes to treatment for any other health condition, you know, you start to get into so ethical issues about people being mandated to get a medical treatment. That's a whole conversation way beyond the scope of this time and session. I would love to see treatment effective, accessible, low-threshold treatment available to everyone at the moment when they want it, and I think it's shocking that in the U.S. we will make people either have to get arrested before they can access treatment, wait 6 months to get into a treatment program. It's one of the things that I hope the confluence of ACA and the Parity Act means that people will have more access to better treatment. So I'm not a fan of coerced treatment, and I'm not a fan of people being mandated into treatment, but I also know that it's hard to see people that you care about not accessing treatment at the same time, and I know that many of us wish there were ways to force people sometimes to access treatment, but I don't know that that actually is in their best interest. That was a more personal statement than I had to make. I think Portugal offers us a good model where they did two things, and one was they changed their criminal penalties and eliminated the criminal penalties for drug use and drug possession, and simultaneously they created a social and a health capacity that hadn't previously existed, and I think that we need to do both. So we need to make treatment more effective, accessible, and available, and we need to eliminate the criminal penalties for drug use. And I think we can't, either one without the other wouldn't work. It has to be both.
So we have 2 minutes remaining in the session, so trying to stay right on time. Thank you very much. Thank you to the presenter, and thank you for coming.